Without advertising, we'd never be able to find many of the goods and services we take for granted, from movies to automobiles. We not only respond to advertising, we depend on it, and yet isn't it the industry we love to hate? Terry O'Reilly has spent decades in the ad business. He tells us about its past, present, and future in The Age of Persuasion, How Marketing Ate Our Culture, written with Mike Tennant and published by Counterpoint. I'm delighted that it brings Mr. O'Reilly to our show today. Welcome.
Well, it's great to be here, Leonard.
Now, there's a kind of a reference to a book about advertising from the past that got a lot of people up in arms, The Hidden Persuaders. Is this kind of intended to be a counterbalance to that?
Well, it certainly could be. Why Mike and I really wrote the book was we really wanted to take people inside the hallways of advertising. Because Mike and I are functioning ad men, we wanted to bring people inside into the boardrooms of advertising to see why certain decisions are made the way they are, to film shoots, to radio recording sessions, to strategy sessions, because it's a pretty fascinating business. And once people understand how it works, I think they have a different perspective on it.
Has the popular culture confuses the man in the gray flannel suit, more now Mad Men on television?
Right. It's kind of a hot topic right now, advertising. It's kind of, you know, risen to the top in pop culture, no doubt about it.
You say advertising is at its best because at giving the customer something informative and entertaining. Well, how entertaining is it? It seems to me that ads were a lot more entertaining in the past than they are now. Those Alka-Seltzer commercials, and I remember Peel's Beer with Bert and Harry Peels. Today's ads, dad is always a bit of a dunce,
yeah.
Or we have these guys, these beer-drinking 20-somethings who act like sexist fools.
Yeah. Very, very true. You know, I think that there was some really wonderfully great work done in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Tougher now. It's a tougher world now. Clients coming out of a recession in particular, coming out of a very conservative era in a very conservative time, that affects creativity in advertising in a huge way.
Because they want to play it safe.
They want to play it safe, and they're all about, you know, price and item and value. Everybody thinks in a recession. It's very interesting. Many marketers think in a recession that you can't be creative. It is not the time for creativity. It's the time to talk forthright. I believe it's probably the biggest time to be creative. Still, you still need value at the heart of the proposition, but you still need to be creative to be heard.
Well, you're out of Canada.
That's right.
Is advertising different in Canada than it is here? It is in Europe.
Big difference in Europe. Canada and the U.S. are pretty kindred spirits when it comes to marketing. Madison Avenue really has affected everything I think we do up in Canada, too. There might be a little more self-deprecating humor in the advertising in Canada, more so than you might see here, but very similar.
Has anybody counted how many advertising messages we see in the course of a typical day?
Very interesting question. There's a rule of thumb that's probably anywhere between 3,000 and maybe 5,000 a day if you were to count everything. I did an experiment one morning, Leonard, where I got up in the morning and counted every ad that I was exposed to between 6:30 in the morning and 9 a.m. when I walk into work. So just that little brief period of time. So I counted everything I have. I listen to the radio while I shave. I take a quick flip through the newspaper. I drive into work. I see all the boards. In that small period of time, the count when I stepped into work was 99.
Of course, if you're listening to public radio, you might have had less.
You might have had less. That's right.
You say that there's an unwritten contract between the advertiser and the customer.
Probably.
Most people tell you they hate advertising, yep. And that contract is one that they want to break. Are you saying that they're being dishonest with themselves?
Well, a contract does have two ends to it, doesn't it? That's the most contentious chapter, I think, in our book. It's definitely created the most controversy. The premise we feel is that all advertising should give something back to the listener. And the minimum is an entertaining or informative ad. But really beyond that, it should underwrite something. Like on television, the ads underwrite the programming you love. And on most commercial radio stations, they pay for the programming, et cetera. Even public radio and magazines, they support the editorial. So that's the give and take. That was the contract forged with listeners back in the 20s when radio first appeared. If you sit through our radio ads, we will give you programming. When advertising breaks that contract, that's when the irritation with advertising goes up another click.
And so what is it doing instead?
Well, sometimes it's not giving anything back. So the obvious one is telemarketing, just really calls to interrupt your dinner and wants to take and doesn't really give you anything. But even, I mean, I can't speak for in the States, but I know in Canada when cinema ads went into cinemas, I don't think the price of tickets came down, right? So that would have been a great give and take there.
Do we have to distinguish between marketing and advertising?
Well, yes.
Advertising, they work hand in hand, don't they?
They do. Advertising is a subset of marketing. Marketing is a huge umbrella term that could involve labels and events and promotions, where advertising is purely broadcast or print commercial messages.
They say that half of every advertising dollar is wasted, but no one knows which half.
The famous line, yeah. From John Wanamaker a century back. Well, that is very true. Here's the thing about advertising. I mean, there's a lot of science involved in advertising because there's research and focus groups, and we really want to know a lot about consumers. The flip side of it is, at the end of the day, and you may remember this from your days back, Leonard, in the business, that you're still faced with a blank page, and it still takes enormous creativity and ideas.
As people, my response to the people who said they were the hidden persuaders, I said, well, then every ad should work. But
right.
Some products fail even if they have brilliant ad campaigns.
That's right. That's right. Even the Edsel, which is the one most people reference, it's still a mystery to this day why that product really didn't work.
Because it was the grill, don't you?
Could have
really
been the grill.
Goofy looking.
But they did a lot of research before they put that car out. It wasn't like they just threw a dart at a board, right?
Mm-hmm. My guest is Terry O'Reilly, who's written with Mike Tennant, The Age of Persuasion, How Marketing Ate Our Culture. It is published by Counterpoint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about newspapers going out of business or cutting back magazines. Right now, network television is in serious problems, all because people are cutting back on their advertising budgets. And that was occurring even before the current economic crisis
hit.
So what's happened? Is advertising thinking of new ways of reaching the consumer?
I think that's fair. I think that's true. I think a lot of money, you can see in our business, 20%, 30% of money that was in traditional media is now going to digital media. So that means, you know, there's not a lot going to network television anymore, or even commercial radio, or you see newspapers really, really struggling. It's interesting that newspapers were really the first advertising medium, and they are now the first to really take a tumble. Like, it's a really interesting progress.
Now, does that reflect the decisions of advertisers as to where they're going to get the biggest bang for their buck? I would assume that TV would still be a good place to be. Is it because cable has divided up the audience so much that it's hard to reach the kind of audience you would in the past?
That is one of the big problems with television, is there's so many channels now, it's hard to find your audience. And it gets expensive because they hop, skip, and jump over the course of an evening. So you've got to make all these continuous buys across different shows, across different stations and networks. So it's a very expensive play, whereas in the old days, as you know, if you bought Bonanza and Ed Sullivan in the 60s, you'd probably reach 80% of the American public, right?
You said that advertising began in newspapers. Where were the earliest ads?
Well, probably if you take a step back in history, posters might be the true first thing, where people would just stick things on anything, any posts or lampposts in the city. But I think maybe the first ads happened out of an agency in Philadelphia. That was probably in the late 1800s, where it really became. You know, it was funny. I was reading last night. I was on the Advertising Hall of Fame website, and I noticed, quite to my surprise, that Benjamin Franklin was in the Advertising Hall of Fame. And I was kind of shocked by that until I read that he was, of course, a magazine publisher.
Poor Richard's Almanac.
That's right. And
did they take ads?
Yes, they did take ads. And not only did they take ads, and they took the most ads of that era at that time, Benjamin would write most of the copy. So he is, in fact, inducted in the Advertising Hall of Fame, which I, as an advertising historian and fanatic, never knew.
Well, when I look at old ads, they all seem rather quaint, naive. How did they go about deciding what to how to approach the consumer?
In I think prior to 1904, all advertising was just news. In other words, this product is now available. In 1904, this very seminal thing happened where there was this gigantic agency in Chicago called Lord & Thomas. And in 1904, a Canadian, believe it or not, copywriter and ex-Mountie, sent a note from the bar at the bottom of the building up to the top, the president's office, saying, "You don't know how to advertise, but I do. I'll let you in on the secret if you invite me up," which is a pretty intriguing note to send to the president of an advertising agency. So his name was Albert Lasker, the president. He was so intrigued that he said, send the man up. The man came up and said, "Here's what you don't know. Advertising is salesmanship in print." That was an epiphany in 1904, because prior to that it was just news. What he was suggesting was you need persuasion and convincing and charm.
And you need to find some kind of way to intrigue people to make them read the rest of those ads in those days. Very wordy.
Very wordy, very dry, absolutely.
Were the newspapers supported by advertising dollars as they have been in more recent years?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. That was the biggest source of revenue for them.
What about radio and television? Well, radio. In most countries, when broadcasting began, it was usually a national service, the United States being the exception. So was broadcast advertising begun in the United States?
You know what? That's a very good question. I would say yes, because it started so early. I think the first ads that we found historically were in the mid-20s, 1920s, and radio wasn't around too long before that. So I would say it was probably an invention of the U.S.
And how long before the soap operas came into being?
Very quickly on the heels of that, I would say probably in the 30s. That was another invention of Albert Lasker, by the way. He wanted a vehicle to put ads in. He wanted to generate an audience. So his agency started to create soap operas. And, of course, as everybody knows, soap opera comes from the fact that he was putting soap clients in those early serials. But he created soap operas as a way to draw an audience, and so he can put his ads in. And that became, of course, to this day, still in use.
Although soap operas are a dying breed,
yes.
Perhaps a reflection of changing tastes or different way that people use television?
It is an interesting phenomenon as to why they are suddenly disappearing. I suspect it is changing tastes. I'm wondering if the melodrama of soap opera still plays in the 21st century. It might be a 20th century phenomenon.
Well, they play in other countries. Telenovelas and the like are very popular around the world, perhaps because they came later.
Yeah.
What about jingles? Do we know when the first jingle was composed?
Yes, we do. The first jingle was probably in 1926. It was for Wheaties. Wheaties was the first jingle ever created, as far as anybody can tell. The second they put a jingle together, sales shot through the roof. It was this amazing way of getting attention. And even to this day, although jingles are very out of favor in my business, probably the 80s were the last hurrah of jingles, they still are a very effective form of getting somebody to remember something. Not to persuade them, but getting them to remember something.
Well, now what they're more likely to do is take a popular song and use it as a jingle instead of composing something new.
Yeah.
Do we know where the word jingle comes from?
I don't know the answer to that, Leonard. That's an excellent question. I don't know.
There was a time when ads were longer. Now, what is a typical ad these days? 15 seconds? 30?
Well, radio's mostly 30. Television gets into smaller increments of time, although I know that in Boston recently, they were experimenting with one-second radio ads called blinks.
1 second?
1 second. I don't know what you can do in a second. Actually, I can tell you a very interesting story about one spot that was 1 second long that won the top honor at the Cannes Advertising Festival about 2 years ago. All it said was, it had this sequence, a stopwatch beep, beep, and then a voice said, "Guinness Book of World Records," and then there was a rim shot. It was 1 second long, 0.9 seconds long. The reason the judges loved it so much was because not only did it tell you who it was in 1 second, but it demonstrated the benefit of the book being that it created its own entry, world's shortest radio commercial.
When I worked in advertising, and one of the places I worked for was a company that sold records on television. And we needed 2 minutes to sell Slim Whitman and Boxcar Willie and Jim Nabors and all those people that were so wonderful. Because one of the reasons that business has kind of disappeared, except for Time Life, is you can't get 2 minutes anymore.
You can't.
Nobody was willing to sell you 2 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that is one of the problems, I think, as our culture gets shorter and shorter, the increments of time get shorter and shorter in my business is I worry about it because I don't think you can persuade people in 1 second or 5 seconds. The adage in our business has been always the more you tell, the more you sell. So I would much rather have a minute to sell you something than 5 seconds.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to ask you about David Ogilvy, about Doyle Dane Burnback, and some of the other things that have changed advertising over the years. The book by Terry O'Reilly, who's my guest, along with Mike Tennant, is called The Age of Persuasion, How Marketing Ate Our Culture. It's published by Counterpoint. Stay with us. We're back with Terry O'Reilly, who is an ad man, and he is joined by Mike Tennant in creating a book called The Age of Persuasion, How Marketing Ate Our Culture, published by Counterpoint. A listener asks, what do you think about Sesame Street's use of the commercial format to sell curriculum like the alphabet to children?
Well, you know what?
To some degree, they're co-opting the culture has already prepared us for.
I think
but
so.
Some people might say they're teaching kids to listen to ads.
Well, I guess you could make that assertion. I mean, when I look at that, I think that they're being very smart about using probably a lot of the learning medicine avenues had over the years to get people to understand, especially in small bite-sized pieces. I mean, it is an art to relay any information in small bites. So I have to think that that's probably a very smart thing.
You talk about the people who really had major impacts on advertising. David Ogilvy, what did he do?
David Ogilvy was very inventive. He was probably the best essayist in advertising as well. He was the most articulate man in advertising history when it came to writing down why and how this business works. So he brought a lot of class and charm to advertising because he was a very cultured man. He was from England, from Britain, came over here in the 30s, started his agency in 1948-49.
Was Mather his partner at the time?
That was just the backing. That was the English shop that backed him up here, so there was no Mather ever here. Oh. But he started his agency at age 39. If you can imagine that, and became this gigantic agency that still functions to this day, Ogilvy and Mather. So he had a huge impact on the business. He brought research to the business, loved research, because he'd worked for George Gallup before starting Ogilvy and Mather, so he had a big, big love of research. So his research, his love of research, his class, his charm, the first class ticket he gave clients like Rolls-Royce and Hathaway Shirts and Schweppes was really new in Madison Avenue.
He was also creating images for his clients. The Hathaway man with the eye patch, you couldn't forget it. It was really about a shirt, and yet you were seeing a man in an eye patch.
It was almost as much about the man as it was about the shirt. And just an interesting thing
That's
I always...
It's like Marlboro Man later, isn't it?
It's exactly right, personifying the brand with an image, which is so interesting. Even Ogilvy, on the way over to that first photo shoot for the Hathaway shirt that morning, he, on a whim, went into a drugstore to buy that eye patch, by the way. He just had a whim, picked it up, asked the photographer to take a picture of it, and knew they were onto something.
Now, for a long time, advertising really was kind of like a WASP club.
Yes.
And people from other groups, Jews and Italians, for example, were considered too ethnic. That all changed after the war, and it changed advertising.
It did change advertising because it led to some incredible agencies, and the one that we always cite is Doyle Dane Burnback, started it also around the same time Ogilvy started his shop in 1949. And Bill Burnback was Jewish. There were a lot of Jewish and Italian writers and Greek writers, George Lois being another of the great art directors. But that agency changed everything on Madison Avenue. It brought, for the first time, wit and humor and incredible strategy, too, as well. And you have to know that at that time, Madison Avenue was very sober. It was very dry and earnest.
I just saw an ad for Volkswagen that says, "Think Blue." And that is a reminder that their first great campaign from Doyle Dane Birnbeck was Think Small.
Think Small.
That almost revolutionized advertising.
It did. It did. Think Small was probably one of the biggest ideas advertising as an industry ever had. Remember, contextually, too, it was that ad came out around 1960 when Detroit was making bigger and bigger and bigger cars, more chrome, heavier. Think Small was such a radical idea to say in the auto industry. The next ad in that campaign, of course, was Lemon, which is maybe the most toxic word you could ever use for a car. And that was the headline on the next famous Volkswagen ad. So they were doing things nobody had ever seen before. They were talking to the public in ways the public had never heard from an advertiser before.
And it caught their attention. Isn't that part of the problem? We're just, as we said earlier, inundated with ads. I remember an ad a few years ago that began with, which I took as, "Pay attention."
That is true. That's very funny you say that. That is my task as an ad man, is to come up with a creative idea that will get somebody to stop and watch or listen to the ad. Because we can't sell anything until somebody notices your marketing.
The big problem for many people is they feel that you're trying to sell us something we don't need. And we have an awful lot of lousy stuff out there that is marketed, sugar products that are marketed at kids, people concerned that cigarettes are being marketed for kids. There's an awful lot of stuff that we probably don't need that I'm not sure the iPad is needed. And
right.
Yet there's a major marketing campaign behind that. And I think they've already done billions of dollars in business.
Yeah. Well, that is the big swipe at advertising, is that it does try and sell you product. There's no doubt about that. I mean, there's always a flip side to that. I completely understand that point of view. I mean, the other flip side is that it does perform a necessary task inside. Our economy is, it does keep the gears moving. It does keep companies healthy, hopefully, people employed, etc. And I'm being very lofty with my sentiment here, but it does have a place in our economy.
Do you talk to people who've been in the business for a while about Mad Men?
I do.
What are their feelings? Do they feel that it's an accurate depiction of the business?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because the Mad Men I talked to came out of some of the more creative agencies, and they look at Mad Men and don't think it's accurate at all. So they don't. The womanizing and how women are treated in that show, they take exception to. As a matter of fact, talking with Bill Birnbach and Doyle Dane Birnbach, their copy chief in 1959 was Phyllis Robinson. So there was one of the top agencies, the top role filled by a woman.
Women often rose to high positions in advertising, especially in retail advertising.
Yeah.
Macy's and Gimbel's both had advertising chiefs who were women because they could rise there where they couldn't in other businesses.
That's true. And remember this, too, that most advertising is aimed at women. There's stuff aimed at men, but the bulk of it's aimed at women, because women are the chief financial officers of the family.
Now, we've been hearing psychologists got involved in figuring out how to make more effective ads. Now we're hearing about things like data mining. And I guess those are the things that also scare a lot of people.
Yeah, and I get that too. I mean, I'm very ambivalent on that issue, Leonard, because on one hand, as an ad man, I want as much information about you as possible. Not to pry, but I want to understand you so the advertising I create is relevant. On the other hand, I'm a consumer too, and when I go and buy a pair of socks at a store and they ask me for my phone number, it drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at my
code.
And your zip code. And I look at my daughters. I have three teenage daughters, and they so easily give away their information online. And my wife and I are always so fearful of that. But then I realized that one of the reasons they do it is because they know instinctively that if they give away information, what they get back will be more relevant to them. So I complain about spam, and they don't. Very interesting to me.
Well, anybody who receives spam complains about spam.
Yeah, but they don't get much of it, is my point, because what they send out, they're getting more relevant stuff back.
We hear a lot about viral marketing and guerrilla marketing. What are those?
Guerrilla marketing is very interesting. It's where you're really using unpaid, and I use media in a loose term, and I'll give you an example. So in a park in Boston one day, if you're walking through this park, like Central Park, there were a bunch of sticks thrown on the ground, literally branches, and they had a yellow piece of paper wrapped around them, and they were just spread all over the park. When you picked it up and unraveled the yellow piece of paper, it basically said, "Wouldn't this stick be a lot more fun if there was a dog attached to it? Adopt at the SPCA." So that's a guerrilla marketing campaign. There's no paid media. It's really, you know, they took advantage of public space and they got a lot of attention. And all it cost was to print up those little pieces of yellow paper.
We've seen that a lot in political advertising. Some group does a political ad, runs it in a small market. It makes the news, and they wind up with a national ad campaign, even though they don't pay any more money.
That's right. Even remember when Timothy McVeigh was being executed, PETA went to him and said, "Can you help us make a statement? Make your last meal a vegan one," which is an outrageous demand, which he said no, and he had a big steak and ice cream, et cetera. But the fact they'd made that request
from a man who killed hundreds of people without thinking twice about it.
That's right. But it got them a ton of press.
Do advertisers get upset when their ads are parodied on YouTube?
Only if they're bad. So they love the attention, but that's the big fear with YouTube is you have to give over control of your message. So when people start to riff on it, if it's positive, it's great, and if it's really, really bad, you have to live with that as well. So the all press is good press scenario is Mike and I really don't believe that when it comes to brands.
You say that advertisers take customer complaints seriously. So if we write a letter to an advertiser, will that really make a difference?
Let me tell you something. This is probably one of the biggest secrets of marketing and advertising. Clients take letters and emails now of complaint very, very seriously. Every ad man will tell you we all have stories where major campaigns have been pulled because six letters came in. So they're very, very sensitive to customer feedback.
And then you have to think about ads to overcome other problems. Toyota right now seems to be trying to figure out what kind of strategy will work best.
They've got a lot of strategizing to do. They're really even had more trouble today, I read. So they need more PR than advertising. They really need to try and it's going to take them a while to get back in the good books with people now just because there's been so many problems in a row.
Do you have a sense of what the worst campaigns ever are? The ones that were most disastrous. The new Coke didn't do very well.
No, that's right. That wasn't really the result of a campaign, though, as much as it was a result of fiddling with the product itself, right? One that's cited in our business, although I have to say I liked it, but it was a big disaster, was the Burger King Where's Herb campaign. And I don't know if you remember that, Leonard, going back, that might be 15 years or more ago. You're old enough. The whole idea was that there was only one person left in America that hadn't tried a Whopper, and his name was Herb, and the whole country was trying to find him. I thought that was a very funny idea for a hamburger, and it had an ongoing sequential cereal type of feel to it. It was well done, and it just didn't resonate with the public.
On the other hand, does a really well-received ad, one that everybody loves as television entertainment, does that necessarily sell the product?
Well, Well, yes, but I always say this. You hear many people, and they'll come up to me if I'm at a party or whatever, and they'll say, you know, I love this ad, but I can't remember the product, so it didn't work. And what I wonder is two things. Sometimes the ad wasn't aimed at you. So if it's not aimed at you, a lot about it may not be appealing to you. So you're not remembering the basic benefit. And then, of course, the other thing is the strategy may not be right. So you've got some wonderful creative at work, but if the strategy isn't meaningful, it doesn't offer you something that truly fits into your life, it's not going to register with you.
Well, you say that advertising is an art, not a science,
it
but
is.
With all of the demographic information available, all the psychological studies, Why isn't it more scientific?
Because it all comes down to that blank piece of paper, and you still need a creative idea. And persuasion is an art. It is not a science. It still comes down to creativity. You have to wrap a creative idea around a strategy before it'll ever be noticed and it'll ever make an impact on somebody. So when it still comes down to artistry, which is what I'm talking about, an art director and a writer trying to compose copy married with art, with an idea that they think is motivating and compelling. And, I mean, that's why the subtext of our book is How Marketing Ate Our Culture, going back to your earlier question. When there's 3,000 or 5,000 ads being hurled at you, it's only the creative idea that's going to make a breakthrough.
We always associate advertising with capitalism, but I remember Mayakovsky, the great Soviet poet, wrote ad copy in the early days of the Soviet Union, and I've always wondered about where the line between, well, in that case he was selling galoshes, but where propaganda picks up where advertising ends.
Very interesting, and you're right about that. I mean, they are really, in many ways, and you could probably argue with me on this, two completely different and separate things, propaganda from advertising. Because advertising is very product and brand-centric, whereas propaganda
Weren't the Nazis with the swastikas and all of the branding that they had, weren't they?
They had a branding machine at work there. There's no doubt about that. I mean, in that regard, they're using the same tools, I guess, Leonard, but I don't see it as the same thing because they weren't commercial messages per se, right?
You've done a couple of series of public radio programs for the CBC about advertising because you feel that you're working in a misunderstood industry?
Well, when Mike and I first pitched the radio show, we said to CBC in Canada, we would love to create a show that takes people, as I said earlier, inside the walls and boardrooms of advertising. And we have this desire that if people knew more about advertising, they might look at it in a different way. But more than anything, we wanted to celebrate the best work done in my business. There's a lot of bad work, but we wanted to celebrate the best work done in the business. And say to listeners and readers, only spend money with the advertisers that give you great advertising. Really. Like, only spend your money with the ones who respect you, who, if the ads felt like they were done by somebody who cared about you as the end listener and viewer.
Well, we have less than a minute left, so who should I be spending my money with? Who do you think is doing the best advertising now?
Well, I love Apple. I think Steve Jobs is probably the best marketer of our generation.
I hope you don't say Coors Beer. I'm okay.
No, who else do I love out there? I love IKEA. There's a number of really smart, consistently great advertisers that do such. Even my favorite ads right now are actually for Old Spice. That I don't know if you saw that TV ad. It's already up over 8 million views on YouTube. It's astounding.
Terry O'Reilly has written with Mike Tennant, The Age of Persuasion, How Marketing Ate Our Culture. And the book is published by Counterpoint. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
It's been
a pleasure.
Of course,
this is a form of advertising, isn't it? Although,
it is.
Of course, I deny. We did not get paid for this.
That's right.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Leonard.